Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. In this show, we'll travel to a farm in Clay County, West Virginia to meet 6-year-old beekeeper Abigail Grandin, who talks about why the bees are so important to her dad.
Help daddy with getting honey. It helps daddy feel better.
Abigail's dad, Army veteran Eric Grandin, says he's found therapy through farming and beekeeping.
People don't spend time together anymore. You know, they're too occupied with gadgets. It worked in the past. It really did. It brought people together, families together.
He learned farming through a program called Veterans and Warriors to Agriculture, coordinated by veteran James McCormick.
They defended and secured the country, and every one of these people have a heart, and they know that there's kids in those schools that are not getting a decent meal at their house.
Right. You'll find these stories and more this week, Inside Appalachia. Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Can farming help people who are going through an especially rough time in their lives? Some veterans say yes. Today on Inside Appalachia, we're going to listen back to an episode we originally aired last year about veterans who are turning to traditional farming for therapy. About 9% of West Virginians are veterans. That's higher than the national average. As a matter of fact, the Mountain State has the fifth highest number of veterans per capita in the nation. And tragically, 20 veterans across the country commit suicide each day, often as a result of post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD.
PTSD is something that you think is going to be forever, which sometimes it is.
This is Army veteran Eric Grandin. On this show, we're going to get to know Eric and find out more about a program that's helping him find peace and purpose and a way to live with PTSD. It all started with a phone call to an Army veteran, retired Captain James McCormick.
It was a 4-hour-long conversation. It was as if we were brothers, no doubt that we shared a bond. So I could tell that Eric was struggling. And I remember thinking after getting off the phone, I've got to find something for him to be.
After that call, a friendship formed between Eric and James, and they created a new program that's helping them both find peace and purpose. It's called Veterans and Warriors to Agriculture, and it's helped over 300 veterans learn how to farm. McCormick is the coordinator of the program. It was created 4 years ago, and McCormick says it's so popular they get about 30 calls a week. For Grandin, making that call to James McCormick changed his life.
This, you know, the thoughts are still there, the memories, you know, the symptoms, but, you know, I've kind of learned to find a new normal in my life.
We first heard from Grandin back in 2014 when West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Ashton Mara visited him. The Warriors to Agriculture program was just getting off the ground.
Here, sing your Frozen song.
Let it go, let it go.
Eric Grandin is the owner and operator of Sugar Bottom Farm in Clay County. I met him and his 4-year-old daughter for lunch at one of those small town diners where everything is homemade.
You want carrots and corn?
Grandin is a disabled Army veteran, serving for 20 years on 6 tours of duty. He suffers from PTSD and was deemed unemployable by the federal government after a flashback in 2011.
I was dealing with a lot of pain, and it sent me back to my days at Desert Storm. I worked for an interrogator team at the 18th Airborne Corps Enemy Prisoner of War Camp, and it's just kind of related, and sent me back to February 25th, 1991.
As a patient in the hospital, Grandin says you couldn't make him believe that 20 years had already passed and he was no longer in a war zone.
And another therapist came in. She asked me what I was doing, and basically I was standing at the wall and just working with my hands, and I told her I was doing the mission board, which is what I did. I worked operations also.
Grandin had multiple responsibilities during his military career, but part of it was to interrogate prisoners of war. He says he did not torture POWs, but used some severe techniques, like preventing them from sleeping for long periods of time. When he retired from the Army in 2009, he showed no signs of mental distress to his family. Grandin says he He hid it until that incident, until his life changed. After 2 years of being hospitalized on and off and receiving therapy through the VA, Grandin was introduced to James McCormick, an Army vet himself. McCormick was awarded the Purple Heart multiple times, also suffered from PTSD, and was starting a movement that today is the West Virginia Warriors and Veterans to Agriculture program. Grandin got involved in the program early on.
You know, he showed me that there was something else, that, you know, and that's what the second chance was. And that's what made a world of difference. And
since, Grandin has turned his family garden into a profitable farm, selling at area farmers markets and even to the State Department of Education for their farm-to-school program. But more than that, Grandin says farming and beekeeping have become his therapy. He no longer needs to see a doctor. Beth Ann Earle, a Navy vet who helps run the Warriors and Veterans to Agriculture program, says that's the experience a lot of their participants are having, finding solace in an unsuspected place.
I actually had a veteran say to me he'd been homeless. He'd been an alcoholic. He'd been drinking and whatnot. Trying to recover, trying to reestablish, failing time after time. And it wasn't until he went to a farm, he went to a retreat, he went somewhere, and he went out and he was working, planting and cleaning a garden. And he says when he picked up the dirt and he rubbed it all over his hands and arms, he says it wasn't until then that the blood came off his hands.
Earle says that was a powerful moment for her. It showed her just what this program could do for the more than 100,000 veterans living in West Virginia. But why? Why is farming, beekeeping, raising livestock, why are they such therapeutic endeavors for these veterans? I posed the question to Grandin.
Purpose. Yeah, I have purpose again.
The Warriors and Veterans to Agriculture program has helped dozens of veterans so far across the state transition from the military to careers or just hobbies in the field of agriculture. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Ashton Mara in Charleston. Grandin was the first veteran to go through the Warriors to Agriculture program. Today, he's a full-time farmer and beekeeper. His mentor, James McCormick, started out as a farmer by growing bamboo as well as sorghum, a traditional Appalachian food that's become quite rare in the Mountain State. Sorghum is a type of sweetener that's like a syrup or molasses that used to be grown all over Appalachia. But most of the people who know how to make sorghum have gotten older or passed on. Now, there's a festival in Calhoun County that's going to be 50 years old this fall, but lately the organizers haven't been able to find many people in West Virginia who still grow and make sorghum.
And there was a Vietnam veteran who had been the grower for years, and he had unfortunately succumbed to cancer.
So they asked McCormick to help produce sorghum for the festival.
And I had some sorghum just at started about the time that I met Eric and convinced him, you know, to join with me.
The idea intrigued Eric Grandin, but there was one problem.
I knew absolutely nothing about farming at the time, so I tilled the ground for 3 weeks and planted sorghum, and the crop failed miserably.
It was a whole lot of sorghum and a whole lot of stripping and a whole lot of seed head cutting. We did okay with it, and we took it down with that. Now, his crop, like he said, didn't do as well, but Eric had purpose then, and he had a focus and a direction, and you could just see the light that was there in his eyes, and then getting him involved in the beekeeping, and then seeing that this could be so much more.
I made 10 gallons my first year, made 55 my second year, made 22 this year due to the drought, and, you know, my plan is to continue. I'm not looking to make a money on this product. I'm looking to bring back some fellowship. It's a lot of fun, a lot of hard work, to bring back a dying art. It's just like stitching a quilt, you know. Grandmas did it all day long. You know, mother-in-laws still do it. Daughters, not so much. So, you know, we're losing a lot of family traditions here as we progress as a state, a country, because of technology. You know, it's no longer needed. You don't need those old-fashioned ways when, you know, you can go to a drive-through. But the satisfaction of doing it yourself, growing your own, you know, feeding your family, that's become very important to me.
Through the program, Grandin found more than one teacher, including a former miner from Clay County.
Him and I are great friends now. He's teaching me the art. This is not something you can read in a book and do one or two times and master. He's been doing it for 30 years. I'm hoping it doesn't take me that long. But there is definitely an art. If you don't have a good cook, like I say, you don't have a great product. I have a great product every time. I have no problem selling the product. Usually I'm completely out within 2 weeks. I sell it during making it. If people see us processing, they'll pull up and say, do you have any? Sure. I mean, the jar is still hot. So,
This work has also changed James McCormick's life. He struggled with his own readjustment issues when he returned home after 22 years in the Army, which included two combat tours. He's a highly decorated soldier, having received the Silver Star, the Bronze Star, and the Purple Heart. But now, the former officer focuses on helping his fellow veterans and saving them from despair and potential suicide.
And if we don't take this serious, if I would have just hung up the phone on Eric, or if I would have said, you know what, buddy, I'm sorry I can't help you because we don't have a budget, because we don't have this, we don't have that. If you don't have a budget, then you go pull your own quarters out of your pocket and you make it happen. If it's going to save somebody's life or it's going to give them focus and purpose, what's a few bucks going to hurt you?
Since he first began farming back in 2012, Grandin says his business has grown. He sells produce through a co-op called the Mid-Ohio Valley Edibles. Four different county school systems now buy his fresh veggies, including lettuce, kale, broccoli, sweet peppers, and tomatoes.
Mostly grape tomatoes. The schools love them for their salad bars. Very labor-intensive, but it's worth it.
They defended and secured the country, and every one of these people have a heart, and they know that there's kids in those schools that are not getting a decent meal at their house.
Right.
And when every one of them that I go talk to, and, I mean, we'll get emotional if I get into it too deep. But they can't stand the thought of a kid going home hungry. And they'll go out there. The labor-intensive part about them cherry tomatoes, they know that those kids will eat those. And so they'll put in the time. They won't make a lot of money at it. But they do it because they love what they do. There's got to be love involved in it. There's got to be a love involved in it. And when these children show up and they know that they're eating what he grew, and maybe even his own child's eating it, they take it
she does.
Very seriously. Very, very seriously.
For the past 2 years, the West Virginia Commissioner of Agriculture, Kent Linhart, a veteran himself, has asked the state to invest in West Virginia veterans.
It is so important that we put some focus on this program and properly fund it, because we know, even just in its infancy, of at least 8 veterans that say that they're alive today because of the program. We know that can heal those wounds that we can't see.
This year, the West Virginia legislature and Governor Jim Justice approved Linhart's appropriation request of $250,000 for the WVDA Veterans and Warriors to Agriculture program. This is the program's first state budget appropriation. Previously, the program was only able to accept donations up to $7,500 and was ran mostly by volunteers who donated their time and did their own fundraising. With new funding, Linhart hopes to expand services and outreach, as well as create a 4, 8, and 12-week agriculture training program specifically designed for veterans. West Virginia's Warriors to Agriculture program is one of the first and most successful of its kind, according to the Farmer Veteran Coalition.
West Virginia has a, you know, very impressive commitment to helping veteran service members, you know, make that transition.
That's Lenam Bakam, Deputy Director with the Farmer Veteran Coalition. According to their website, the national nonprofit organization assists military veterans looking for careers in agriculture. He says West Virginia's Warriors to Ag program is a perfect example of a growing movement of veterans exploring agriculture for therapy, especially in rural communities across the country.
In farming and ranching, there is an appreciation for the land, you know. You are part of something bigger than yourself. If you're a farmer, you're raising and growing a lot of food, and that's food that your neighbor, your family, your friends, and people around the U.S. and the world are going to eat. That's big. That's way bigger than yourself. And in the military, these guys get it. You know, they're part of something bigger than themselves. And so when they can find that type of environment that recreates, you know, maybe what they had at home or maybe what they experienced in the military, you know, they gravitate towards it.
Up next, we'll travel to Clay County, West Virginia, to tour veteran Eric Grandin's farm. There we'll meet his 6-year-old daughter, Abigail, who knows a little something about bees.
Do they ever sting?
When they're mad, yes.
You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. We'll be right back.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Ground control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom. Take your protein pills and put your helmet on. Ground control to Major Tom. Commencing countdown, engines on. Check ignition.
This is Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. This song, Space Oddity, was written by David Bowie and performed by Wilco during a recent Mountain Stage show. Mountain Stage is another podcast you can find at wvpublic.org.
This is Ground Control to Major Tom. You've really made the grade. And the papers want to know who shoots you where.
In the first part of our show, we heard from veteran Eric Grandin, who struggled with his own sense of reality after suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. Grandin says he lost his purpose in life after returning home from war. But farming has helped him find a new normal in his life. Grandin says beekeeping in particular helps him cope with his PTSD and the stress of transitioning back to civilian life after his military experience. Roxy Todd caught up with Grandin and his daughter Abigail at their farm in Clay County.
We are in the truck in a Vapa, and we're at our garden.
This is 6-year-old Abigail Grandin. She's taking me on a tour of her dad's farm.
We have a pretty busy house.
Abigail takes me up a steep hill to see the bee boxes that hum with her dad's honeybees.
The most important thing for the worker bee is they feed the pollen to the baby bees.
Abigail has her own protective bee suit, and she loves helping her dad check the bee boxes. But we don't get close to the bees today because of the weather. It's cold and rainy, and as Abigail knows, the bees are likely to sting when they're grumpy.
Do they ever sting?
When they're mad, yes.
Her dad, Eric Grandin, asks Abigail to talk about why the bees are so important to him.
Help Daddy with getting honey.
Her dad leans in to whisper in her ear the other special thing about beekeeping.
It helps Daddy feel better.
The bees are awesome. When I work with bees, I'm an absolute normal person. It takes away all my anxiety. I've learned bees recognize anxiety. So if I'm having a bad day, I stay away from the hives. I've learned if I go into them having issues, they're going to notice it, and I'm going to end up walking away swollen, which I do not like. So when I go work my bees, I flip over a 5-gallon bucket, sit with them, go through every frame, you know. It may be slower than a lot of people do work with their bees, but I'm not there to rush through the process and just get it done. You know, we're there for each other. I'm helping them grow. They're actually just, they're healing me.
Grandin is 50 years old. His struggles with PTSD went undiagnosed for decades. He says he started having symptoms back in 1990, and his wife noticed, but they didn't talk about it for years. He had a major flashback around the time Abigail was 9 months old. Now, 4 years after he started farming, he says he feels like he's gotten his life back.
I've met others in our program that will tell you they have saved their life. You know, bees have saved my life. Agriculture has saved my life.
Many of the veterans who have gone into agriculture echo Grandin's claim that beekeeping is therapeutic. There aren't any scientific studies on this, at least none that have been published. But anecdotally, many advocates of veteran farming programs say they've seen beekeeping help people like Grandin. This is how Grandin explains it.
Comparing bees to our society, every bee has a specific job in the hive. As soon as a bee is born, and you can actually watch them come out, you know, and be born, and they'll turn around and clean up their cell for the queen to come by and lay another egg for another bee to be born. It's a beautiful thing to watch. They work together, 60,000 bees in one colony, one queen. Each one has a specific job. They don't argue. There's no, you know, second thought to what they have to do to survive. Whereas our society, it's nothing but conflict. You know, he's this, you're that, you think this, I think that. You know, there's no cohesiveness. Military, we have cohesiveness. I think it brings me back to what I used to have and the harmony, you know, working as a team or, you know, everybody thinking the exact same way to accomplish something. That's what the bees do. And they do it in such a harmonious way. Just the sound of them. If I have trouble sleeping, which a lot of people with, you know, PTS do, I listen to a recording of the beehive. That sound is enough to put everything out of my mind so I can sleep.
Beekeeping is also something Grandin gets to do with his daughter and his wife. They all have projects on the farm, and they work together and stay busy. And that's another reason Grandin says farming has helped him find a purpose, because it's something he shares with his family.
People don't spend time together anymore. You know, they're too occupied with gadgets. It worked in the past. It really did. It brought people together, families together, doing stuff together. And, you know, with the veterans, a perfect opportunity. You know, we help each other heal.
I just come down here sometimes.
Abigail likes living on this farm, too. She likes walking through the woods and through the greenhouses. One of her main jobs is gathering eggs from their chickens, which roam freely around their yard outside.
We have chickens, a lot of little chickens.
There's also a guinea that likes to perch on their balcony and make a lot of noise.
That's the guinea again. See? Noisy guineas. That's the noisiest one.
Grandin says farm life is a lot of work for his family, but he's proud to be able to give his daughter the chance to have space to run and play. He's also proud that she likes working with her parents, raising food that they eat all year long. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Roxy Todd in Clay County, West Virginia.
There's the What's in a Name theme music.
What's in a Name is a segment here on Inside Appalachia where we explore the history and folklore of Appalachian places. So we just heard a story about a farm in Ovapa, West Virginia. Can you guess how that community got its name? Ovapa is a very small rural community in Clay County. Today, there aren't a lot of jobs in the area, but that wasn't always the case. Believe it or not, there was an oil boom in this area in the early 1900s. The word Ovapa is actually a combination of three oil companies, which also happen to be the names of three Appalachian states. So which three words do you think were combined to make Ovapa? We'll have the answer after the break. This is Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly with the answer to this week's What's in a Name quest. So how did the town of Ovapa get its name? Well, according to an article written by Perry Woofter that was published in History of Clay County, West Virginia, 1989, before the 1920s, the small community of Ovapa used to be referred to simply as Summer's Fork. In 1923, the first oil well was drilled here. After the area was discovered to be rich in natural resources, other oil companies began moving into the area and there were plenty of jobs. As the community boomed with new industry, a post office was built, and the town was named after initials of three oil companies, Ohio, Virginia, and Pennsylvania. Thus the name Ovapa. If you know another story about Ovapa or ever heard of another town that you wondered how the heck did they come up with that name, send us a tweet at InAppalachia and we might explore it inside Appalachia. According to the Department of Health and Human Resources, 40% of West Virginians who called the state's suicide lifeline last year were veterans. We've covered this issue in other shows, and we'll continue to find out what's being done to help these veterans. In today's show, we focused on one type of treatment some veterans say is life-saving. By doing something so simple as farming, beekeeping, getting outside with their families, and working with their hands. This isn't a solution that will work for everyone, but it has saved some veterans. And maybe sharing these stories will provide hope for some veterans and their families still struggling. You can find more information about the Veterans and Warriors to Agriculture program on our website at wvpublic.org. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. On today's show, we've talked a lot about farming and its important therapeutic aspects. Now, in the second half of our show, we're going to lighten things up a little bit and probably make you a bit hungry. We're going to find out more about a food that you may very well have consumed in the last day. If you've eaten grits, if you had cornbread, heck, if you drank any soda or whiskey, you've had it. I'm talking about corn. But did you know that corn was first domesticated probably about 8,000 years ago in Mexico? So how did corn make its way to our tables here in Appalachia? And what can that history tell us about corn's future? Stephen Satterfield took a journey, well, a couple of journeys, to Mexico and parts of Appalachia to find out.
It's been almost 1 year exactly since I made my initial transformative voyage to the state of Oaxaca in Mexico. That trip was supposed to be about mezcal, the agave-based Mexican spirit that's kin to, or some say, grandmother of tequila. I came for agave, but I got distracted by, of all things, corn. Maize, as it's called in Mexico, it's everywhere. Every meal, every street vendor, every home, every dish.
The corn, the native corn, can teach us one kind of life.
Amado Ramirez is a restaurateur who's developed a reputation as much for his commitment to preserving indigenous corn as serving it. He's traveled to various regions of Mexico, purchasing, educating, and encouraging indigenous communities to preserve their native maíz. This is not like those yellow ears and their pale green straitjackets sold in produce sections in summertime. I knew that. But I didn't know exactly why that was the case. I wanted to know the stories of maize, but I didn't know how to ask the right questions. Amado offered a starting point.
The Green Revolution. You know what is the Green Revolution?
Amado's laughing heartily because he knows that, even though I nod yes, it's clear, I don't really know much about this Green Revolution he's talking about.
Perhaps it's necessary to talk about the history from the comp.
Please. It's necessary in this story, too. And don't worry, we'll come back to the Green Revolution. But that conversation with Amado a year ago got me on a corn kick, and I've been asking questions about maize ever since. I should say first that I'm no corn expert. I'm not a farmer, seed saver, or geneticist. What I am is an intensely curious person, and especially about food. I'm in awe of the diversity of the things we eat and drink and how little we know about where they come from or how they came to be. Back in 2004, in my final weeks as a teenager, I decided to go to the Western Culinary Institute in Portland, Oregon. The plan was to become a chef, but it didn't take long to realize that cooking at home and cooking for a living weren't the same thing. I focused my attention on something that seemed to have more long-term promise, wine. Notice an early recurring theme in my career choices. I learned about wine from a soft-spoken, silver-haired man named John Eliason. He was a part-time wine educator and part-time winemaker. He taught me that Burgundy is not a generic name for inexpensive wine in giant bottles. It's actually just a tiny and legendary region just a few hours south of Paris. Mr. Eliason spent his formative years studying in that part of France. He returned with his lessons to a town called McMinnville in Oregon's Willamette Valley, a patch of blessed soil so close to Portland it's basically a suburb. It's home to more than 500 acres of beautifully manicured vineyards that produce wines ranging from the pleasant to the profound. This is where I learned about a concept called terroir. Basically, terroir refers to how the natural environment impacts wine. Soil, climate, altitude, and ecology. All these things play a role in the final product. This framework completely changed the way I thought about all the things I ate and drank, including, eventually, corn. Corn is part of my own Southern history. I have over a century of Southern blood swirling through my veins. 5 generations, to be exact. As a descendant of slaves, I can trace my ancestors back to the precise plantations where they worked. Corn cooking runs through my belly and my bloodline. Corn became the perfect opportunity for me to ask my favorite question, but this time with an anthropological twist. Not just, where'd this come from, but how did it get here? And so, back to Mexico I went. One of the things that tripped me out in Mexico was how tortillas have been utensils there not just for hundreds, but thousands of years. It's not that Mexican people developed maize. In fact, it's the other way around. Maize developed Mexico. It was the central catalyst in the formation of the country, Amado told me.
The corn is the master, yeah, the master. In Asia, for example, was the rice. In Europe, wheat, trigo,
wheat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, by us is the corn.
Bueno, los mexicanos estamos hechos de maíz.
We Mexicans are made of corn.
Consumimos el maíz.
We consume corn daily in different presentations.
En diferentes presentaciones.
That's Flavio Aragon Cuevas, one of Mexico's foremost experts on native corn. He doesn't speak much English, so we're giving him a hand with the translation. If I was in Oaxaca and I was learning about corn, then I had to meet Flavio. Here, he is the keeper of the corn. In part, it's his job, but after meeting him, it's clear it's his identity, his passion. He often uses his own time and money to track down indigenous seeds.
Por ejemplo, estos que tienen colores rojos, ¿no?
Que vienen varios, ¿no?
Vienen varios en el mismo material.
Flavio took me inside an impressive seed bank at an institute that's basically like Mexico's USDA. Here, hundreds of heirloom seeds from throughout Mexico are kept under lock in a secured walk-in. He oversees a garden plot where he tests seeds and starts from various parts of the country, always trying to make a connection. In addition to corn, he has the most native species of Oaxacan beans, squash, and chili peppers.
El maíz es parte de la vida de los mexicanos.
It's part of our lives for us Mexicans. All over Mexico, from north to south, east to west, we all eat corn in different iterations, not just as tortillas.
No solamente tortillas.
We have many different uses for corn. There are some products that consumers don't even know are made out of it. And in rural areas, corn is a fundamental way of getting nutrition.
Fundamental para la alimentación.
So clearly, Mexican people strongly identify with maize. And the reason is that corn's earliest ancestor comes from here.
The most accepted theory about the origins of corn that comes for the scientist, Teosinte is the ancestor, the grandfather of corn.
The story of corn begins with this wild grass called Teosinte, and the indigenous people who, through centuries of crossbreeding, grew with it. It's an upright plant with bottom-heavy, bushy stalks. It has what wouldn't really be fair to call a cob. It looks more like asparagus, with a rock-hard shell encapsulating the seed.
Many archaeological sites in the country have found that Teosinte has existed for many thousands of years, more than 6,000 years. In fact, in many of the caves here in Gilán Naquits, near Mitla, they found the most ancient archaeological sites of corn and squash. A squash from 10,000 years ago, and corn is 6,000 to 7,000 years old. They found fossils not of the ancestors of corn, but of already domesticated varieties of corn.
Ya domesticadas de maíz.
After seeing Flavio's Teosinte and further researching it, the fact that native people evolved this grass into what we call corn is a testament to their agricultural brilliance and intuition. Genetically speaking, yes, there is a kinship, but it'd be really hard to see that from looking at this wild grass with the dark casing that wraps the seed. There are some culinary uses, but broadly speaking, it doesn't warrant the effort. There is no consensus on the origin story of maize, but just about every scientist agrees it was the result of human beings crossbreeding this wild grass over and over until it became corn.
Flavio really has been the person who's done the most work to conserve it, to keep it growing, to really keep it from going out of existence.
That's Martha Wilcox. She's the Maize Land Race Improvement Coordinator at the International Maize and Wheat Improvement Center, or CIMMET, as it's more commonly pronounced. CIMMET is headquartered in Taxcoco, Mexico, an old rural town about 15 miles northeast of Mexico City. If Flavio is the person to talk to about corn's origins, Martha helps me understand how it spread around Mexico. Martha's from North Carolina and clearly loves learning about corn. She spent most of her adult life studying it and working to protect and promote heirloom varieties. Here, on CIMMET's large campus, there are demonstration gardens full of scientists and enormous walk-in refrigerators more reminiscent of bank vaults. Martha has organized a long table in one of those walk-ins with indigenous corns for me to look at and ask about. She points at one called Pepetilla.
This hook, this beak on the end, is really characteristic of Pepetilla, and it has a high oil content and makes very spongy, light tortillas. And this will come in, I've seen variants that are purple, yellow, black, red, white. So it comes, mostly it's in white, but you can find variants.
And it has a very interesting pattern as well, the way that it's sort of organized, like almost arrows.
Yeah, it's kind of stacked.
Right.
Like stacking chairs or something.
The Pepetilla is just one of two dozen varieties of maize Martha has arrayed before us. Mexico is a country with enormous geographic diversity, so the maize evolved to match each little local microclimate. Each kind was tuned to its environment.
Wet coastland, lowland tropical areas to dry lowland tropical areas to transition zones and subtropical zones and wet and dry and mountainous zones where even from one face of a mountain to side to another you change the differences in diseases and everything else.
It finds the place it likes to grow best and thrives there. Corn's natural proclivity to grow vigorously in favorable conditions not only helped varieties of maize in Mexico, it's what enabled corn's global proliferation. and that helps us understand the story of how it ends up in the southeastern United States.
We've been listening to Stephen Satterfield, who produced this story for the Gravy Podcast. Coming up, we'll hear how corn made that transition from Mexico to the American South. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. Listening to this story about corn has got me thinking about one of my favorite Appalachian foods. That's right, cornbread. Especially when it's served with brown beans. Ugh, now that's a meal. So, I'm curious, how often did you eat cornbread growing up? Do you still eat it today? We'd like to hear your story about corn and cornbread. Send us a tweet at InAppalachia or send us an email to feedback@wvpublic.org. And who knows, we may read your story on the air. We're going to pick it back up now with Stephen Satterfield's story about how corn from Mexico made its way to our region.
Throughout history, farming communities quickly adopted corn. Once farmers learned the growing patterns for each variety, the corn responded with frequent and abundant harvest. That's a big part of how it came to migrate beyond Mexico and into North America.
Almost immediately, there was this diversification.
Stephen Satterfield is a writer different and multimedia producer living in the San Francisco Bay Area.
Different
that
environments.
Story first aired
and
in the Gravy Podcast, you know,
this is
a program
strong
of the Southern
selection
Foodways
pressure
Alliance.
By the people who were spreading
week,
this corn
for
to
me as we journey throughout
develop
Appalachia.
These new varieties and different types of varieties that were adapted and specifically to the region where they were growing it. And that process just continued.
That's Jim Holland, research geneticist with the U.S. Department of Agriculture. He lives and works in North Carolina. He learned about an old corn variety there called Hickory King and wanted to know more about it. It led him following a trail of corn genes to Mexico. Jim says corn first entered the U.S. from a nomadic farming population, crossing a highland corridor along the Sierra Madre Mountains, appearing first in New Mexico or Arizona about 4,000 years ago. It is thought to have also taken the lowland route into New Mexico and Arizona about 2,000 years later. So, the first traces of maize in North America are found in the Southwest.
So you have corn that gets adapted into the southwestern U.S., is grown under very dry conditions, very specific kinds of agriculture are developed to grow corn in mostly desert conditions. And what happens is those corns are quite different than the corns that, let's say, came here to the southeastern U.S.
So, how does corn move east? Slowly. Hunter-gatherer societies moved eastward little by little as they figured out and adopted corn as an anchor agricultural product. So gradually, the natives figured out what would work best in a particular geographic area.
Probably about 1,200 years ago or so, there is the shift, and it happens not just in the North Carolina, but it looks like throughout the southeastern U.S. and probably more widespread than that, there's this shift from this kind of hunter-gatherer type societies to a more settled farming type of culture. And accompanying that is this shift where maize or corn becomes really an important component of the farming systems.
What kinds of corn landed in the southeast? You got to understand some nerdy terminology first.
There are these, we call them land races. So the plant breeders, we call these land race populations. I think the typical people might recognize the term an heirloom type varieties. And they really go back probably at least hundreds, probably thousands of years in this more or less in the same region. So they've been maintained for a very, very long time.
Here's where Jim's starting point with corn comes back in.
Probably the most commonly grown heirloom variety for the southeast that's used for food is Hickory King.
Over and over in my research, I kept hearing about the link between the indigenous corns of North America and Mexico. Martha mentioned it too.
In the area where I grew up of North Carolina, that southern Appalachian area, there's a old land race that's still produced and still sold called Hickory King.
Back in Mexico, Martha told me they'd figured out it probably came from Tuxpano, a town in the coastal state of Veracruz.
Hickory King, interestingly enough, its thought comes from this race, Tabloncillo, and I don't have a white version.
At Cement, we're walking around this long table, carefully investigating the distinctive qualities of beautiful, multicolored cobs and baskets. Each basket has a laminated white card on the front with the scientific name of the corn.
It's not as big as these maíz anchos, but they're pretty broad grains and they're flat and they'll expand like that flowering that you get with pozole that you also get with hominies.
Martha is showing me the anchos and she's right. The Hickory King is totally reminiscent of hominy.
I haven't seen this documented, but I'm assuming that that's a Cherokee, that it comes from the Cherokee, that the whole idea of making hominy, I would guess, came from the Cherokee.
This brought me right back to terroir, that phrase from when I was learning about wine. Eating indigenous, regional maize like Hickory King, prepared as the Cherokee did, connects us with particular places and particular histories. And it connects the native people of Mexico with the native people of the United States. But in the middle of the last century, our relationship to corn got thrown off track. Corn ceased to be about nutritional sustenance and soon became industrial animal feed, fuel, or high fructose syrup. It has been bred for its productivity for thousands of years. In that sense, it became a victim of its own success, of its own special and immutable ability to be so many things at once. The Green Revolution, that Amado mentioned to me back at the beginning of our story, and which I should have known about but didn't, that's when things started to go wrong with maize and man and womankind.
The Green Revolution began here in Mexico. This farm began in 1965, here in Mexico with the corn. Began with one engineer from USA.
He's talking about Nobel Prize-winning American scientist Norman Borlaug. Borlaug was known as the father of the Green Revolution, or the man who saved a billion lives. He was lauded and ridiculed in equal measure for engineering insanely productive maize and wheat that fed Mexico and other developing nations. But what was lost in the exchange were nutrient-dense indigenous varieties of corn that fed the souls and soils of Mexico.
In this time, the paradigm was industrial production. I need more production. I produce in the kind of with machine and engineer for produce more. Yeah, and then the engineering produced the hybrid corn. Why began that in Mexico? Because Mexico have very much a diversity.
Diversity. Again, the very thing that made corn in Mexico special. There were so many different kinds. Made it the place to experiment with the kind of hybrid corn that's taken over everywhere. In the South, where I'm from, I can't help but think about all the diversity that has been bred out of our region. Suddenly, I understand that surging feeling Jim must have gotten from his Hickory King epiphany. That what's there in North Carolina has roots to a diverse corn history in Mexico. My mind runs wild with thinking about possible future scenarios. When we look at this history, we have so many examples of Mesoamerican and indigenous populations breeding corn specifically for culinary use. And today, interest in food culture has never been higher in our nation. I'm envisioning the untold corn flavors there are, a full palette and a blank canvas. I'm dreaming of our own regional pozoles and tortillas with distinctive flavors, unknown and rediscovered. Jim Holland thinks we should recruit chefs and well-intentioned eaters to a corn crusade.
I'm not sure what the ultimate sort of structure would be for kind of an organized effort, but I think we need to just start talking as the first thing. So, for example, I've been doing this kind of work with these Mexican food types. Really, when I started, which is more than 10 years ago, nobody ever talked about this sort of stuff. And I was just interested in it. And I think the sort of food movement has kind of grown up completely independent of, you know, some of these genetic efforts. But now it's clear that there might actually be some interest. There might actually be a market for these things, which would be fantastic.
My corn journey was a surprising one. The Inquisition back in time left me awed by the agricultural competence and organization of early indigenous populations. Eating in Mexico is an invitation backwards into thousands of years into Mexican history. The grain facilitated the growth of a nation, and a nation of people sustained the grain by keeping it in their diet. I found repeatedly, talking with historians, scientists, or ordinary Mexican people, that an inquiry into their favorite dish would lead inevitably to an impassioned discussion about food and invariably corn. It's hard to say whether or not they knew the value of what they'd helped preserve, but certainly that value was felt. And I think we could develop that same appreciation through our dinners here. We may not be the center of origin for corn, but we are the continent of origin, and nothing is more American than eating corn. Growing and cooking a diverse variety of it can help us tap into these traditions, lost, found, and undiscovered.
Stephen Satterfield is a writer and multimedia producer living in the San Francisco Bay Area. That story first aired in the Gravy Podcast, a program of the Southern Foodways Alliance. Listeners, we want to hear from you for an upcoming episode. Do you identify as LGBTQ? What has it been like to live in Appalachia? Send us a tweet at InAppalachia or record yourself using the voice memo function on your phone and email it to insideappalachia@wvpublic.org. Until next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from the Gravy Podcast. Music in today's show was provided by Dinosaur Burps, Ben Townsend, Dr. Turtle, Michael Hitchcock, the Bing Brothers, and Wilco as heard on Mountain Stage. Our What's in a Name theme music is by Martika and William with Johnson Ridge Special from their album Songs of a Tradition. Patrick Stevens is our audio mixer. Suzanne Higgins edited our show this week. Roxy Todd helped produce. Jesse Wright is our executive producer. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. Find us on Twitter at InAppalachia or at Jessica Y. Lilly. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Downcast, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia, with career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.